Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We have got some great interviews for you this week here on Eat Drink Indie Radio. First up, we'll be talking with celeb chef Graham Elliott, longtime host of MasterChef and MasterChef Junior. The chef and restaurateur will be headlining the upcoming Indie Star Food and Wine Experience October 8th in Carmel. And he talked with us from Chicago about the event, family life, working with kids, and about his new restaurant, Gideon's Suite. And because it's pawpaw season and I've been working on pawpaw recipes lately, we'll hear from Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield. But what are pawpaws and why was I talking about them on Wish TV's Indie Style program last week? Well, they're a native Indiana fruit with such a unique taste that they deserve more coverage. So we'll revisit an interview from last year with Bob Wendt about why he grows pawpaw trees amid the evergreens on his Lost 40 Christmas tree farm. And since we're opening the Eat Drink Indie Radio archives, we'll also revisit some interviews from a couple of Indiana wineries, because our wineries deserve more coverage too. First, we'll head to southeastern Marion County for a visit to Buck Creek Winery, where you'll notice grapevines growing right off of Interstate 74. We'll talk with owner Jeff Durham about why he chose that location and about some of his award-winning wines. We'll also revisit an interview with Blake Loudermilk of Easley Winery, which is located right in downtown Indianapolis. The Urban Winery offers regular tours and popular events, and Blake fills us in on what's new at the downtown winery. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We tend to talk a lot about food events here on Eat Drink Indie Radio. The Fantastic Food Fest, the Mac and Cheese Fest, the recent Baby Got Brunch Fest. And now we've got another big event coming up, the Indie Star Food and Wine Experience that takes place October 8th at Clay Terrace in Carmel. Headlining the tasting event is celeb chef Graham Elliott, longtime judge on MasterChef and MasterChef Junior. The Chicago-based chef, known for his bow ties and signature white specs, will be doing a cooking demo at the event, as well as signing copies of his book, Cooking Like a MasterChef, 100 Recipes to Make the Everyday Extraordinary. Purchase a VIP ticket, and you get the chance to say hello to the chef at a private meet-and-greet event. The local food and wine experience is part of a multi-city tour, so we caught up with Graham after a recent visit to Detroit. We talked by phone about the upcoming Indie Star Food and Wine Experience, what attendees can expect, what kind of questions he gets, how he juggles family and career, and why he's happy to be staying in Chicago.
The Food and Wine Experience events are taking place all over the country, recently in Detroit and Lansing, Michigan. So how was Detroit?
It was awesome. I so excited to be able to go to Michigan because my dad and his side of the family are all from Saginaw. And, you know, to be able to come back and be part of that and the resurgence of Detroit, it was great.
So attendees, they're excited to see you, kind of a hometown sort of thing, or at least a little bit of a homecoming for you?
Yeah, it was great. I think a lot of people turned out, and, you know, it's the first time they've done this event. So, you know, to have this crowd and, you know, all the chefs and everyone else, you know, being very energetic and excited about just, you know, the whole food scene was great. Yeah, I was very excited and honored to be part of it.
Well, it is nice to read about the resurgence in Detroit. Anything in particular that you noticed while you were there?
What I noticed was how many people from Chicago have moved there recently in the chef world, from Grey Ghost to Gold Cash Gold,
right,
to, you know, Apparatus Room, all of these chefs and you know, bartenders, mixologists were in Chicago two or so years ago, and they've all decided out of everywhere in the world they're going to pick up and they're going to go to Detroit. So that was pretty cool.
Now, is that, do you see that as a greater trend in the industry, you know, sort of leaving the more high-ticket, higher-expense sort of cities and going to places like Detroit?
I do. I think that the Midwest has a lot of great areas, be it Indianapolis, St. Louis, Milwaukee, places like that, that have an infrastructure of clientele as well as, you know, museums and culture and, you know, music, things like that, where you're not spending $1 million on rent, you know, and on staff and things like that. So you're seeing a lot of chefs up and coming, you know, people that want to do their own thing and their own art, go and relocate to these kind of spots.
When you're in Indianapolis, very shortly, you'll be doing a cooking demo and a VIP meet and greet. So what can attendees expect from an event like that?
You know, I think that they're going to see a lot of chefs come out and really get to know them, see the personality, you know, out there doing demos. But what I always tell people when I do a demo is it's not like TV. It's not like a restaurant. There's no big, you know, glass wall in between us. We're all there hanging out, cooking, and, you know, Q&A, whatever you want to do. So that's my favorite aspect, and I think that that's what the crowd generally enjoys as well. And then being able to taste and see what all the local chefs are doing is really exciting.
Now, do you have the demo dishes all planned out in advance? Do you decide decide on the spur of the moment what you're going to do, or how does that work?
No, you know, I generally have an idea of what I think is going to do well, but then a lot of it, just like in a restaurant, depends on the season, the weather, things like that. So I'm lucky enough to where, for me in particular, I can go down and I'm close to the city, being here in Chicago, that I can just put some stuff together and get there and do what I'm feeling.
So now when you do a demo, do people get to, will they be able to see fairly up close what you're doing?
Yeah, you know, they're able to come up, ask questions. Generally, they don't taste the food, you know, just because it's hard if there's 100 people.
Well, and that big of an event, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're not cooking for 100 up there on the stage, right?
No, exactly. That gets hard. But, you know, it's funny because a lot of times people will ask different questions, you know, where sometimes it's, how much of this did you add? Sometimes it's, am I able to make this at home? And then a lot of times it's nothing about food. It's just like, tell us about Gordon Ramsay.
Now, do you have some favorite questions that you like to get from the audience or some that are surprising?
You know, I guess for me, it's I was able to travel around the world growing up, my dad in the Navy, things like that. So to be able to share some of that story and history and my journey is really, really fun. So the more, not the more personal questions, the better, but just, you know, realizing that we're all equal and having fun with food and wine and the town that we're in. You know, I hope that people can feel free to ask whatever.
Well, now, I mentioned early on that you're a chef, a restaurateur, a cookbook author, and certainly a TV personality, very well known to MasterChef and MasterChef Junior fans. How do you describe yourself? What are you, first of all?
You know, first of all, I guess, you know, I'm a dad, and you know, I have three boys, ages 5, 7, and 10. So to be able to cook with them and get them excited about food and, you know, secondly, you know, being try to be a great husband and then a chef that, you know, is able to, for whatever reason, be on TV and show, you know, my thoughts on what food is. So, you know, I am very, very honored and humbled to be able to do that. You know, obviously, when I started, I was a dishwasher and found a love for cooking and realized there are a lot of great chefs out there doing cool stuff. And, you know, that's what I went with and just been very excited to be able to pay bills doing this.
Now, there wasn't anything else that you intended to do somewhere along the line? You know, I was going to be a fireman or an astronaut or something like that?
You know, I sang and played guitar in a punk band and was hoping to be the rock star, but then I found out all chefs are failed rock stars.
Well, that's what I hear. I think someone told me that they all have a guitar in the closet.
Absolutely. I've got a big collection, but, you know, play by myself. So there's all, you know, and then there's a million musicians that do the same thing with food. So it's really funny.
Well, that is sort of an interesting juxtaposition there. But, you know, you mentioned a dad and husband, you know, coming first. Of course, the food business is notorious for being difficult on relationships. How do you manage to juggle all that?
I have an amazing, supportive wife who was also in the food and beverage world. That's how we met at the Peninsula Hotel here in Chicago. So I think she understands that just kind of comes with the whole thing, and it's quality over quantity. So if I'm gone a lot of weekends or, you know, doing events out of state, things like that, then we just stay in contact. Luckily, there's FaceTime and everything else to chat and talk to the kids with. And then when I'm here, you know, being able to make the most of everything. And then, you know, for the first 6 years when we were filming MasterChef in L.A., all my family would come with me, and we'd be out there for 3 months or so at a time.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was fun. But now that they're in school, that's one of the main reasons I'm not doing that show anymore, is I don't want to leave Chicago. I don't want to live in L.A. when my house, my kids' school, restaurant, everything is here. So it's more important to, you know, make that decision.
So do you consider Chicago home now, or are you a Midwestern guy?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I have been for 18 years. I've always been in Chicago and filmed in L.A., but now, you know, I'm on Top Chef and Top Chef Junior, and that schedule is a lot more conducive to family life because you're not gone this entire time. You're going to film, then you're off for these 4 days, and you can fly back, and 2 weeks later go and do another episode. So you're not just picking up and moving for 4 months, you know, to another city and leaving your family behind. I don't think I'd be able to do that.
We've been talking with celeb chef Graham Elliott. He'll be headlining the upcoming Indie Star Food and Wine Experience in Carmel on Saturday, October 7th. For info and tickets, go to foodandwine.indiestar.com. And we'll be right back with more from Graham here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio talking with celeb chef Graham Elliott, who's headlining the upcoming Indie Star Food and Wine Experience October 8th in Carmel. He'll be doing a cooking demo at the event, signing copies of his cookbook, and chatting with VIP ticket holders. But the Chicago-based chef also talked with us about his new restaurant, Gideon's Suite, which will be opening in Chicago later this fall, about getting kids to cook, and trends he sees in the restaurant biz.
Well, tell us a little bit about your upcoming Chicago restaurant, Gideon's Suite, right?
Yes. So, you know, we just got out of a meeting half an hour ago, which was awesome. So we're going over all the, you know, materials and logos and images and menus. But the idea is a very cross-cocktail forward restaurant that's going to have, you know, a bunch of amazing drinks on tap and, you know, artisan type of ingredients and aged liqueurs. And then the food, there's going to be about 20 dishes that are all made to be almost ordered by the piece. So imagine like canapés or hors d'oeuvres or dim sum.
Dim sum, right. Okay.
You can order a bunch of pieces of. So I think there's nothing like it around here, and it's going to be very exciting, very loud and fun.
Well, now tell me a little bit about the name. That's the name of an apple, right?
Exactly. So it's like a 100-year-old heirloom apple varietal that, you know, was almost extinct and is now coming back because some people, you know, they love the flavor and they want to grow it and see it out there. So I think that it's a pretty great name for what we're doing.
Now, do you like that process of planning and launching a restaurant? Is that fun? Is that energizing?
That's the most exciting part, you know? Like, you can come up with a menu and, you know, some beverages and things like that. But when you're looking at it as a whole with everything of equal importance and saying, okay, the uniform, the music, the room, the lighting, all of those things come together to create a restaurant. And I love that idea. And what's really exciting is this restaurant is a partnership between myself and Chef Matthias Merges, who's here in Chicago and happened to be my mentor 18 years ago when I moved here at Charlie Trotter's. So we're combining forces, almost like a band, and just saying, let's hang out together and let's do this project.
Oh, my goodness, you're getting the band back together.
Exactly.
Well, that sounds very fun. What other types of projects do you hope to do? Are there any other areas of the food business that are sort of intriguing to you? You know, I don't know, more TV or product development or anything else?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a kid's cookbook, which I think will be really fun. I love teaching, and to be able to get that across to, you know, the youngins and show them that food can be something beautiful and artsy, or, you know, something that uses math, history, science, the arts. That's really cool. It's liberating, I guess. And if they know that they have that as an outlet, it's really rewarding. And another thing, I think living in Chicago and being on the South Side, you see that, you know, there's a lot of kids that don't know how to cook. They don't know about ingredients, any of that stuff. And I would love to start, you know, maybe a nonprofit or, you know, charitable foundation where I can go and try to teach kids in maybe the lower income areas or public schools, whatever it is that I know, how I can try to make a bigger impact, I guess, on the city, if possible.
Well, talk a little bit about your work with kids. So, you know, with the MasterChef Junior, Top Chef Junior, that sort of thing. What's it been like? Why is it appealing, you know, working with the kids like that?
I think there's such an excitement that they bring to the table, you know, no pun intended, but there's an innocence to their cooking, you know, which is how I like to cook. You know, looking at it, there's no right or wrong. You kind of unlearn what you've been shown and go at it with a fresh set of eyes, and it makes it that much more fun to cook. And when you see them doing it, it helps you as a chef come full circle and realize that maybe you had preconceived ideas of what cooking is and now you can change it.
Is it ever, you know, do you ever feel like, oh my goodness, here I am, you know, this is chef who has Michelin stars, and I'm on TV and I have cookbooks and I'm critiquing a dish made by a 10-year-old. Is that odd? Is that good?
For me, again, I think that whether it's TV or there's a million stars and awards or whatever, it's okay. You know, I like to wake up and cook whatever I feel and do my thing. And if someone likes it or they think it's worthy of something, or you know, they put a camera on you and put you on TV, that's great. But I would still do the same thing. Like at my kid's school, I do a 2-week cooking class for the kids just for fun, and go in there and try to show them stuff, and they get credit for their summer camp and things like that. But they might know me from TV, or they might just like cooking and have never heard of me, but I just love being able to go in there and do it.
Now, you know, the food business is, again, a notoriously tough business, especially for women. Do you encourage kids to go into cooking as a career?
I do, but I think the word chef or the food business has completely changed the last few years. I mean, the chef means someone that owns a restaurant, or is it someone that wrote a book, or has eaten all over the world, or wants to do catering? Like, there's so many different avenues for you if you're into the food world that you can do. So a lot of times these kids come in and they are really excited about being a culinary teacher one day, or they want to just be on TV. They have no interest at all in owning a restaurant. So right now, I think, you know, like I said, I started as a dishwasher and eventually moved up. And, yeah, you're working 15 hours for, you know, 15 hours a day for $5 an hour. That's not happening anymore. You don't see that as much.
Well, that's progress, right?
The business is changing.
Are you seeing any food or dining trends that we should be watching for that are on the horizon and we can expect to see?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if fine dining is officially dead, but I think that you're seeing people still want to do their artsy kind of food or tasting menus, but completely stripped down and almost like you're just going to their house to hang out, you know, open mm-hmm. kitchen, loud music. All the chefs are wearing T-shirts and baseball hats and, you know,
right.
about, you know, white tablecloth and flowers and seven different forks to choose from and things like that. Even wine lists, it's more BYOB or here's a couple of bottles of what we like that's weird and esoteric instead of here's a million-dollar wine list of all these incredible Bordeaux's.
Do you like that? Do you like that trend, that sort of fine food but casual experience?
Yeah, I think that there's still a place. Like, if there was a restaurant like Le Bec Fin in Philly or, you know, one of these old Cirque-type deals in New York where you go in and it's not stuffy but, you know, cream sauce and old French dishes and, you know, servers in tuxedo, I think it'd be fun to go and check that out. Just because you don't see it anymore. So,
right.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, everything comes full circle, right? Right now, it's sure, soon enough, it'll be fancy.
So I know when you've been in Indianapolis in the past, you've gone to Milk Tooth. Are there any other places that you want to hit when you're in Indianapolis?
You know, what's fun for me, because, you know, just in Chicago, like in the last 6 months, there's 10 new restaurants. So I like to kind of get a feel for the zeitgeist and everything going on in the town. So I'll just tweet and get on Instagram and say, hey, I'm coming into town this weekend. Where should I go? And then you get all these different ideas, and I try to hit as many as possible. So I was in Detroit for one night, and I think we went to 5 spots.
We've been talking with celeb chef Graham Elliott, who will be at the upcoming Indie Star Food & Wine Experience. For information and tickets to the event, go to foodandwine.indiestar.com. And to keep up with the chef, and to let him know what to check out while he's in Indy, follow him on Twitter and Instagram at Graham Elliott.
Pawpaws. Now, that's an Indiana ingredient you don't hear much about. Unless, like me, you hear the neighborhood ice cream truck playing way down yonder in the pawpaw patch over and over and over. But just what is a pawpaw, and why is that tune a common folk song all across the Midwest and into the South? As it turns out, the pawpaw tree is found from New York to Nebraska and from northern Florida all the way to Canada. And those trees do indeed grow in patches, or groves, beneath other trees, and they yield the largest edible fruits native to North America. They look a bit like a pear, taste a bit like a banana, and they have the slippery feel of a mango when you peel it. They're not the easiest fruits to deal with. There are big seeds inside, and unless you get a really large pawpaw, there's really not a lot of fruit to work with. They haven't been commercially cultivated until recently, which means that if you do have pawpaws, you probably really have been to the pawpaw patch.
So I really did go to the pawpaw patch when I drove out to Lost 40 Tree Farm this week. Pawpaws typically ripen in September or October, and with the recent hot weather, pawpaw season is upon us. Lost 40 owner Bob Wendt let me know that he had pawpaws available, and since I needed some for a cooking segment on Wish TV's Indie Style program, it was time for another visit. I came home with 5 pounds of pawpaws and started looking for recipes. First up was ice cream, and I have to say that it came out great. In fact, I might go as far as to say this is exactly what you should make with pawpaws. Their unusual tropical flavor is a terrific addition to vanilla ice cream, and since pawpaws retain that flavor best when not heated, it's just about the perfect way to use them. But I also tried a couple more recipes and found that chopped pawpaws make a great addition to salsa, pretty similar to a mango salsa. And they also add a tasty tropical note to a barbecue sauce. Just add them in after you've simmered your sauce, then puree. So I'll be using that barbecue sauce this weekend on pulled pork, dipping corn chips into my pawpaw salsa, and then enjoying my pawpaw ice cream. That sounds like a cookout waiting to happen. But how did Bob Wendt at Lost 40 get into growing pawpaws on his Christmas tree farm? Well, he tells us how that happened.
Well, the way we started in pawpaws is we like wildlife. like raccoons, you know. I mean, what country kid didn't have a pet raccoon when he was a kid or a possum or, you know, something? But we like deer and we like possums and we like raccoons and we like squirrels and rabbits. And we got what's called a wildlife packet from the state nursery. And you can still get a wildlife packet today. And they'll send you, you know, 5 persimmon trees, 5 pawpaw trees, and some trees that have little berries for the birds. And everybody should do it. It's real cheap. You can, I mean, less than a dollar a seedling. Like for $25, they send you a packet of 30 trees that you can plant around your property that's for wildlife. And that's how we started in the pawpaws. We got some pawpaws in the wildlife packet. Well, once they grew up and started to harvest fruit, we said, hey, these are pretty good. And now we've saved the seeds from the original ones, and we now field plant them in rows just like people grow corn. But we've had to learn how to do that, too, because, for instance, pawpaws are used to starting as an undershade tree.
Like in the woods, so they're shaded.
And they actually need shade. If they're grown in full sun, the first year pawpaw will die. It can't take the sun. It'll sunburn. So we have to shade the first year pawpaws. And then after that, if you give them full sun, they'll grow at a much higher rate than a shaded tree will. And we've also learned that they pollinate very poorly. So we actually got Q-tips and put little bits of honey.
You're doing this yourself?
Doing this ourselves, yeah. Put little bits of honey in their flowers in the spring, and we actually trained the bees to pollinate the pawpaws for us. And the best part is you only have to train the bees once. Each generation of bees will train the next generation to do it. Even though there's not much pollen in a pawpaw flower, they've got it in their little bee brains that there is.
From that honey that you've put in there the first time.
That's right. That's right. So we get way, you know, probably 1,000 times more pollination than what wild trees get. And our trees are wild trees. We've just learned how to feed them good and make them grow good.
Well, how much do you get a year from all the pawpaws?
Right now, we're probably at 500 pounds, and I would say we just started to ramp up in the last few years. I would say within a year or two, we'll be up to 1,000 pounds, and within 5 years, we'll be up to 5,000 pounds.
That's a lot of pawpaws.
It is. We've looked around on the internet and seen what they sell for shipped, and shipped, they bring about $15 a pound, which, you know, I don't know how big the market is, but we're going to find out. You know, and if there is no market, I think, well, hey, it's been a lot of fun, and we haven't lost any money, and I think all the things I've done in my life I lost money on, you know, and this would be kind of minor if it doesn't work.
We've been talking with Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield. For more information on the farm, go to lost40treefarm.com. Maybe you've seen the grapes growing along Interstate 74 just south of Indianapolis and wondered who would plant a vineyard alongside a highway. Well, the answer to that question is Jeff Durham of Buck Creek Winery, and that highway location was all part of the plan. He started planting grapes 25 years ago, opened the winery in 2006, and has been very successful at the Indy International Wine Competition, which just took place. The winery was just named Small Farm Winery of the Year and also had the Dessert Wine of the Year. Jeff got the chance to judge at the competition, and I wanted to hear what he thought about judging and to find out more about growing grapes here in Marion County, right by the highway.
Well, we started our winery, the vineyard we planted 25 years ago. For about 13 years, we grew the grapes, expanded the vineyard in size, sold grapes to other wineries. We made wine as amateurs on the side, and eventually opened the winery 11 years ago. Built the winery, decided I retired from my other job, and here we are.
Now, people probably saw over the years, I know I did, saw the grapevines growing just right alongside the highway on 74.
Yeah, that was kind of a business plan that we had. We knew that if people could see the vineyard, you know, a lot of people that have wineries around Indiana, it's grandfather's old farmhouse. It's 20 miles, you know, 10 miles, 5 miles off the interstate. It's great because, you know, that land is free. It means a lot to them. But we wanted, because we didn't have that availability, we wanted to go ahead and find the best location we could. I had to stay in Marion County because of my job. We found a spot right next to the interstate with exit each, 1 mile each way, and knew if we could just put the vines out there, they could see it and they would stop. And as long as our wine was good and we were friendly, we would do well.
So being right here beside the highway has worked out.
It's been great. We've tried all kinds of forms of advertisement. And the one that we found to be the most effective is we've got actually three billboards on the interstate now. And about half of our business is from local folks that know about us in the area. And then the other half is from people that are traveling.
Oh, so that's nice. So you get
the wine and they make their annual stops it works out really well.
Well, talk a little bit about the craft of making wine and how you learned to do that. Were you self-taught? Do you have a background in this?
Well, I was pretty much self-taught. I visited some wineries in Ohio 25 years ago, fell in love with the idea of having a winery. There were a beautiful winery with 4 or 5 acres, really nice wines, right in the middle of Ohio. And I said, if they can do it in the middle of Ohio, we can do it in Indiana. So I looked for land. Again, this looked like the perfect location inside of Marion County. And just purchased the land, took some time to get a variance, zoning issues, planted the vineyard, and it's gone really well.
Now, the idea of planting a vineyard right here, where you're probably closer to corn and soybean fields than anything else. What did the neighbors think, when you started tilling up the land and you're going to plant grapevines?
Well, when we actually had to get a variance, like I mentioned. There were two remonstrators that lived right in this area, right down the street from us. And I think a few people thought maybe we were going to have a smoke bilging factory, or there'd be people driving drunk and crashing into trees. And they didn't understand exactly what it was all about. But now those two groups that remonstrated, 11 years ago are now coming in and bringing their families and friends and talking about their winery, their local winery. So it all worked out really well.
So you've become a local winery. You've become the winery, for people in the area. How has reaction been? Did the wider community embrace a winery here, right off the highway?
Yeah, I really believe that several people came in over the years and they were like, we drove by there for a couple years and we couldn't figure out what you were doing. We didn't know whether it was blueberries or what you were doing. And we just couldn't believe it was going to be a vineyard. And I think people are proud of the fact that they have a local winery in the area. And as well, we do music events that are free almost every Saturday in the summer. They've become a really great way for the community in the area to come out. We have, a food truck. For example, last weekend, I think on Saturday we had 400 or 500 people. On Sunday, we had 300 or 400 people out here with their lawn chairs, playing cornhole with their dogs, with their kids, running around. And we had really good music, and people really enjoyed it. And I think it's becoming a nice little spot for people in the area to go and enjoy their Saturdays.
So tell me a little bit about the recent Indy International Wine Competition that you participated in, both as a judge, and then you also had wines entered.
Yes, it was a really great experience for us, for me, myself, and the winery. I was a judge this year. Of course, everything is blind. You don't know what you're tasting. You can't identify your own wine. But it was an unbelievably great experience for me. I got to talk to a lot of people in the industry that I normally wouldn't get to. And really, the judging aspect was very intriguing and very exciting. Really enjoyed it. And our wines did really well this year. We ended up with 17 medals. One of our wines ended up being Dessert Wine of the Year, one of 5 categories out of 2,000 wines. So one of the 5 wines that was voted Wine of the Year, Dessert Wine of the Year, and that was the second year in a row that wine, it's a Vidal Blanc ice wine, has won that award. And then really unbelievably fantastic news is we were awarded Small Farm Winery of the Year, which made us very proud. We felt very blessed. We've been wanting to, and we've been competing and been close for several years and getting that award, and it was just very exciting to actually receive that award.
Now, tell me a little bit about the judging itself. I got to participate this year, too. Fascinating, challenging. What was it like for you as a winemaker?
You know, it was a really good experience. Learned a lot about how other wines of the same grape, how they're put together, what they taste like. You know, of course, we're not actually drinking the wine. We're looking at the color. We're smelling the wine, checking the aromas, and then we put it in our mouths and we spit it out.
That is kind of interesting. You talk about, you know, you judge 120 wines in a day, but you're really not drinking them at all.
No, you're not. You're not. I mean, you do absorb a little bit, but you're really not drinking the wines. So that aspect was very different for me as well, because that's not my typical way to analyze wines, because there's, you know, a little bit more to it than that, but you have to do that. There was only 50 judges and 2,000 wines. So, you know, it was such a great experience, and I learned so much from the judges around me. They had years of experience. This was, you know, my first year to do the judging in that style, and it was a tremendous experience, and to have our winery do so well in the competition, it was glorious.
Now, tell me a little bit about the wines you entered. They almost all of them medaled, right?
We ended up with 3 double gold medals, 3 gold medals, 10 silver medals, and 1 bronze medal. Only one wine did not win a medal. And we were thrilled. And what they do is they have a formula that they look at as to the how many wines you entered. Did you enter enough wines? What was the awards given to those wines? And they decide who is going to be wine of the year, or excuse me, winery of the year. And it was fantastic. We had a double gold for a red blend that we have that's barrel aged for 2 years. It was voted best vinifera blend in that class, which was very exciting for us, because you have all the entries from California, from around the world, and we're not known as a dry red country, so that was extremely exciting. And my son Joseph actually developed a blend on that, so for a young 26-year-old, it was exciting for him. Being a young winemaker, stepping into, you know, eventually stepping into dad's shoes, it's a great motivator for him, and I was very excited for him.
So it is a big competition, and it is an international competition. 37 states, 15 foreign countries participating in this. So you're not just up against local or even U.S. wines. This was a big deal to go up against wines from around the world.
It was a big deal. It was a great experience. We had judges from Austria, judges from around the country, and these were true professionals. And it was a humbling for me, and I'm sure for you as well, to experience that. And very excited. One of our wines, the ice wine, the Vidal Blanc ice wine, voted wine of the year. Super excited for that.
We've been talking with winemaker Jeff Durham of Buck Creek Winery in Indianapolis. For more information on their award-winning wines, go to buckcreekwinery.com. A lot of Indiana wineries, and there are more than 90 of them now, are located in a rural setting, tucked into a barn or amid rows of grapevines. But Easley Winery is an urban winery. It opened in 1974 on College Avenue in downtown Indianapolis, and the Easley family has been making wine there ever since, and winning plenty of awards along the way. We've talked with owners Mark and Meredith Easley before here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, but this past week I stopped in at the winery to talk with Blake Loudermilk, brand manager at Easley Enterprises. She was a judge at the Indy International Wine Competition at Purdue University, and I wanted to get her take on the experience, see how their wines fared in the competition, and find out what's new at Easley Winery.
So easily ended this year's competition with 3 golds, 1 silver, and 5 bronze medals, which was really exciting. And, of course, Traminet, our 2015 vintage, took a gold. Our Reggae White, which is a Moscato blend now, took a gold as well. And then our new No Opposition Cabernet Sauvignon, which you see there behind you in the red, is our... is also a gold medal winner. So we were thrilled, especially with the cab being brand new. It was only bottled a few months ago. So having a young wine like that win a gold medal was really exciting. We think it's only going to get better with age.
Now, tell me a little bit about your participation in the Indy International, judging and with, you know, entering wines and that sort of thing.
Sure. So I started at Easley in 2014, and shortly after I started, I kind of took over the management of entering our wines into competitions. And we enter anywhere from 10 to 15 competitions a year, depending on, you know, timing and what we have available to enter. But the Indy's always a great competition for us. We always do well. Our wines always do well. We always get excited about it. So I'm the one who enters our wines. And then for the last 2 years, 2015 and 2016, I was a judge in training. So you get to sit at the table, you get to taste the wines, you get to, you know, tell them what you think that medal would be for that wine. And it doesn't necessarily count, obviously, but at least you get a sense of where your judgment would fall compared to the other people at your panel. And that was really helpful. So for 2 years I did that, and then this year they invited me to be an actual judge. And I was so excited because I do a lot of paperwork. I sit at a desk a lot these days. So to get out and taste wines and learn new things was just so amazing.
Now, it's a very big, very prestigious competition. I think we've said here today that there are 37 states represented, 15 countries. So how is it putting your wines up against wines from around the world?
It's so exciting because you see, obviously, so many different things coming from different parts of the world. And we enter things like a Cabernet Sauvignon, you know, and cab comes from all over the world. So you know that it's being judged against worldwide cabs. And I think that's another reason we were so excited that the No Opposition Cabernet Sauvignon won a gold this year. On the other hand, we do enter things like Traminet, where it's mostly a Midwest varietal. So to compare our Traminet versus all these other Traminets from not just Indiana but other states is really exciting as well. I actually think that the Traminet of the year, the best of class Traminet this year, came from a Missouri winery, which was really exciting. But of course, there's always the Indiana Traminet of the year, Indiana wine of the year. And it's so nice that the competition takes that into account and separates those wines out just to see amongst each other, you know, how everybody does. And Traminet's always a big one because almost everyone in the state makes a Traminet. So it's really fun to see, you know, whose Traminets are really excelling.
Well, now tell me a little bit about yours. It's our state wine, right?
It is. Signature Grape of Indiana. We had a large campaign for the grape a few years ago that was actually led by the Purdue Wine and Grape Council. It really got the knowledge about the grape out there, and I think Indiana residents who are at all involved in the wine industry in the state, they now know that they should be able to go to most Indiana wineries and try a Traminet, which could work for or against the winery, depending on whether or not they make one, of course. But some of the ones that we've seen come out of the Indiana wineries have been, yeah, amazing. Like I said, our Traminet, our 2014, was Wine of the Year at the Indiana International, so I mean, it beat out every other wine that was entered, and we were so excited about that.
Now, that is a big deal. I mean, beating out all the other wines that were entered, 2,000 wines.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, that was probably definitely the highest award of the competition, so, and we were thrilled to be able to get that. I believe the year before, our Traminet was White Wine of the Year, and like I said, I want to say our Traminet has won a gold medal for the last 5 or 6 years straight. If not a higher reward.
Now, that's pretty awesome, and yet I'm not sure that people realize that Indiana wines really do stack up in competition with wines from around the world.
Absolutely. I mean, outside of Traminet, obviously, which is the go-to one that we always talk about, but we do also make a Bordeaux-style red blend here. It's called I Think Red Blend. It's Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot. And we entered that in a competition, not the Indy International, but it won best of class at a California competition. And obviously at that competition, you're really up against a lot of California cabs, or red blends, I should say. So to win best of class in a California competition like that, I think people need to start taking another look at Indiana wines and what we're capable of.
And I think that that's been the concern that we, oh, you know, the thinking might go, oh, we really can't grow the top quality grapes, or we really don't make the top quality wine. But that's not true.
Absolutely. And there is a lot of, you know, the grapes have to be grown in Indiana, that kind of idea, for it to be, you know, truly an Indiana wine. But there are a lot of great grapes coming out of Michigan and, you know, out of New York. They're not that far away, but it's really about what the winemaker does with those grapes that's so impressive. And we've seen some really amazing vinifera wines come out of Indiana wineries. Maybe the grapes weren't grown super close by, but it's what they did with those grapes. And we're really impressed with what these winemakers are able to do. Our winemaker has been here for 16 years now, and I think he's really mastered. Obviously, our Reggae wines are our big sellers, and they are selling like crazy. We almost can't keep up with the growth around here on the marketing side, but production is steaming away on those, and we're so happy that we have a winemaker who's able to capture the sweet palate of Indiana drinkers and serve it in a fun package. People are excited to buy it. It's a good price point. That's definitely our winning wines.
Well, now tell me a little bit about that sweet palate. We talk a lot about that. We talk a lot about how, oh, Hoosiers have a sweet palate, or, oh, Midwesterners have a sweet palate. But, you know, they also say that about Southerners or people, honestly, from around the country. So is it really a negative?
I wouldn't say that it's a negative by any means. I personally find, I believe that a lot of times it's more difficult to make a sweet wine than it is to make a dry wine. It has to be balanced. That's key. It's not just sugar water that we're looking for here. It needs to be a high quality balanced wine, and that's what we really excel at here. We pride ourselves in premium sweet wines. The sweet palate that we refer to a lot of times, I think, has a lot to do with what we are brought up on. In the Midwest, we tend to grow up with a lot of, you know, the fruit punch, the Hawaiian punch, the Coca-Cola, the Mountain Dew. So our palates are trained to like that sweet flavor. But I know a lot of dry drinkers in Indiana as well who can still appreciate a sweet wine for being a well-done wine.
And I think that's what you do in judging, isn't it? Is you're looking for what is a good example of whatever category it is. So you had to judge all sorts of things. Tell me a little bit about some of the judging.
Absolutely. So we were all over the board. I wish I had my flight list in front of me just so I could refer back to it. But we did everything from red vinifera down to white hybrid blends to fruit wines to flavored wines, really anything you can think of. And we had some really interesting flights. I had a fruit and flavored wine category, and it was fascinating. There was probably 11 different wines. And even though some panels might struggle with that because overall they were very sweet, I really enjoyed it because even though they were all sweet, you could still tell which wines had been really well done in terms of balance. You're looking for that acidity, not just an overpowering sweetness. And I got a lot of that. There were a couple of wines that I wish I knew what they were, and I would love to go buy them. Obviously I don't know what I was tasting.
Because it is a blind tasting. You have no idea. So even if you, you know, entered wines from Easley Winery, you didn't know when your wines, where they would be or who would judge them or anything like that, right?
Absolutely, because I know I definitely entered some wines into categories that I was judging, but with so many entries, there's no way to know if your wine is in that flight in front of you, and obviously there's more than one panel tasting each of those categories anyway. Yes, I have no idea if I tasted any of our wines, but hopefully if I did, I gave them a gold. We'll never know, but I am...
Tell me a little bit about what's going on right now at the winery.
Sure. So at the winery, our downtown Indianapolis location, and I do, as far as I know, we are the only downtown winery now. Of course, we used to have New Day, but they've switched pretty much over exclusively to Meads. Love New Day, though. But yes, so we are right downtown. We don't have that rural, you know, vines out back kind of look to us. We've got parking lots and skyscrapers around us. So
you are a city winery.
We absolutely are. And an urban winery is really interesting in terms of the marketing you can do with it. That's a lot of where our No Opposition brand came from. It's very rugged, very bold, very ambitious, kind of. It's very, very urban, so we're excited about that. But yeah, so at the winery, we actually every Saturday have Groovin' in the Garden, which is our live music series. It's free. It's from 2 to 5 p.m. Usually usually the weather works in our favor. Unfortunately, if it rains, we usually get just rained out. But we have a great turnout for that. We do tours and tastings every weekend. And yeah, we have a lot of people come through here on a Saturday. It's really impressive. I'm actually working in the tasting room this Saturday, so I'm excited to see what my first Groovin' of the Year is going to be like.
Is there anything new happening at Easley? Anything we can look forward to or things you might want to mention?
Sure. So we've had a lot of infrastructure improvements around here lately. We just installed a new bottling line that is doubling our capacity. So we can now bottle twice as much in the same amount of time, which is amazing. And the other thing that bottling line allowed us to do was a different size package. So we are now doing 1.5 liter, which is two of what you would consider a normal size wine bottle. We can do those bottles. And we are very excited to announce that just this week we released our first ever wine-based cocktail. So we just released a Reggae Margarita. It is wine-based, but it tastes just like your traditional margarita. I'm a big margarita fan, and I love it. So I give it a full endorsement. But we're really excited to see what happens with the Reggae brand. And just there's so many opportunities within that brand for new things that we can do. And I'm excited maybe to enter that into the competition next year. I'm not sure what category it'll go under yet, but I think it would do well. So the things like that, just constant innovation is what you're going to probably be seeing out of Easley for the next few years.
We've been talking with Blake Loudermilk of Easley Winery in Indianapolis. For more information on the winery, including tours and tasting hours, go to easleywinery.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2, The Point. Thanks so much for tuning in this week, and thanks also to our guests. Celeb chef and restaurateur Graham Elliott, who will be at the upcoming Indie Star Food and Wine Experience. Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield. Jeff Durham of Buck Creek Winery. And Blake Loudermilk of Easley Winery. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.